You know, if resistance was a muscle, Cat Brooks would be really buff. She is the host of Law and Disorder, and she has graciously joined us this evening to talk with Chris Sedges. So, Cat Brooks.
How y'all feeling? Thank you for being here tonight. I'm not going to talk too much because I know y'all want to hear from Mr. Hedges. I do want to say really quickly the importance of truth-telling in this moment. Truth-telling is the fuel of resistance. Truth-telling is every single one of our jobs, and truth-telling is what they are terrified of. From the moment that the events of October 7th hit the media, we saw the craft of Israeli spin, and we saw the reach of the Zionist state on American media. Lie after lie, spin after spin, justification after justification, as if you could justify a genocide. Well, what that did do was enable a lot of our fellow Americans to look the other way, to believe the lies regurgitated by so-called left-leaning media like CNN and MSNBC, 24-hour soundbite cycles that somehow encouraged people to close their eyes and their ears as children and women and elders and human beings were bombed to smithereens, as hospitals were closed, as people have starved, atrocity after atrocity after atrocity. And now we have an administration that is actively working to shut down every single possible form, angle, pathway to dissent. The greatest thing that we can do right now is refuse to shut up and commit to truth-telling. Yeah. And that's part of why tonight is so important, right? We're about to spend a couple hours in the truth, and it's going to be painful, and it's going to hurt, and we're probably going to cry. And I will spend a lot of days and hours right now sick to my stomach. But it's what we do with this truth once we walk out of here. Because you're going to be armed with knowledge and rage and passion. And my ask of you, my urging of you, is that you take it and you walk outside and you get about the business of being an accomplice, fuck being an ally. To liberatory struggle. That right now the loudest demand is to free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free Palestine.
Free Palestine.
All right, let's get about the business of why we are here tonight. I have the very distinct honor and privilege of introducing Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is the former Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times, an Arabic speaker. He spent 7 years covering the conflict between Israel and Palestine, much of that time in Gaza. He is the author of 14 books and has taught at several universities, including Columbia, Princeton, and the University of Toronto. His latest book that we're going to discuss today is A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. Y'all give Chris Hedges a town welcome.
Thank you. I just came back from Egypt, where I'm starting my new book with the cartoonist Joe Sacco on the genocide, where we have been interviewing Palestinians from Gaza, and I think Kat and I will talk about that. I just spent an hour sleeping on that couch because of that. My old office in Gaza is a pile of rubble. The streets around it where I went for coffee, ordered maftoul or manakish, had a haircut, are flattened. Friends and colleagues are dead, or more often have vanished. Last heard from weeks or months ago, no doubt buried somewhere under the broken slabs of concrete. The uncounted dead in the tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands. Gaza is a wasteland of 50 million tons of rubble and debris. Rats and dogs scavenge amid the ruins and fetid pools of raw sewage. The putrid stench and contamination of decaying corpses rises from beneath the mountains of shattered concrete. Palestinians risk death from unexploded ordnance left behind after some 20 months of airstrikes, artillery barrages, missile strikes, and blasts from tank shells, as well as a variety of toxic substances, including pools of raw sewage and asbestos. Israel, supplied with billions of dollars of weapons from the United States, Germany, Italy, and the UK, created this hell, and it intends to maintain it. Hepatitis A, caused by drinking contaminated water, is rampant, as are respiratory ailments, scabies, malnutrition, and the widespread nausea and vomiting caused by eating rancid food. Nearly 500,000 people are facing starvation. Some 1.9 million people have been displaced, amounting to 90% of the population. They live in makeshift tents and camped amid slabs of concrete or the open air. Many have been forced to move over a dozen times. 9 in 10 homes have been destroyed or damaged. Apartment blocks, schools, hospitals, bakeries, mosques, universities. Israel blew up Isra University in Gaza City and the Turkish-Palestinian hospital on March 21st in controlled demolitions. Cemeteries, shops, and offices have been obliterated. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA, estimates that clearing Gaza of the rubble will take 15 years and cost between $40 billion and $50 billion. But any rebuilding of Gaza, Israel and the Trump administration have decided, will not be done for the Palestinians. Israeli organizations, including the far-right Nakala organization, have held conferences to prepare for Jewish colonization of Gaza once Palestinians are removed. This is the last chapter of the genocide. It is the final blood-soaked drive to push the Palestinians from Gaza. No food, no medicine, no shelter, no clean water, no electricity. Israel has turned Gaza into a Dante-esque cauldron of human misery, where Palestinians, at least 54,000 dead and 123,000 wounded, are being slaughtered in their hundreds and soon again in their thousands and tens of thousands, or they will be forced out never to return. This final chapter marks the end of Israeli lies. The lie of the two-state solution, the lie that Israel respects the laws of war, that protect civilians, the lie that Israel bombs hospitals and schools only because they are used as staging areas by Hamas, the lie that Hamas uses civilians as human shields while Israel routinely forces captive Palestinians to enter potentially booby-trapped tunnels and buildings ahead of Israeli troops. The lie that Hamas or Palestine Islamic Jihad are responsible, the charge often being errant Palestinian rockets, for the destruction of hospitals, United Nations buildings, or mass Palestinian casualties. The lie that humanitarian aid to Gaza is blocked because Hamas is hijacking the trucks or smuggling weapons and war material. The lie that Israeli babies are beheaded or Palestinians carried out mass rape of Israeli women. The lie that 75% of the tens of thousands killed in Gaza were Hamas, quote-unquote, terrorists. The lie that Hamas, because it was allegedly rearming and recruiting new fighters, is responsible for the breakdown of the ceasefire agreement. Israel's naked genocidal visage is exposed. It is driving Palestinians, many facing starvation from northern Gaza, luring them south to the border with Egypt by setting up a few paltry food stations, none designed to feed the 2.3 million desperate Palestinians, but corral them into caged military zones. It is about engineering chaos, concentration camps. Israel shot dead at least 10 people trying to get aid from the Israel and U.S.-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and this is a familiar counterinsurgency tactic, one the U.S. used in Vietnam. It is about luring people like mice into a trap and positioning them along the Egyptian border to expel them. What comes next is mass starvation, scores of daily deaths from diseases caused by contaminated water and lack of food, bombs, missiles, shells, and bullets. Nothing will function. Bakeries, water treatment and sewage plants, hospitals, schools, aid distribution centers, or clinics. Less than half of the 53 emergency vehicles operated by the Palestine Red Crescent are functional due to fuel shortages, and soon there will be none. Israel's message is unequivocal. Gaza will be uninhabitable. Leave or die. Since March 18th, when Israel broke the ceasefire with heavy bombing, some 3,700 children under the age of 18 have been wounded and 1,300 have been killed, bringing the total during 20 months of genocide to 17,000 children dead and 34,000 wounded, around one in every 20 children in Gaza. In one 24-hour period, 400 Palestinians were killed, and this is only the start. The images from Gaza during the some 20 months of incessant attacks were awful. But what is coming now will be worse. It will rival the most atrocious war crimes of the 20th century, including the mass starvation, wholesale slaughter, and leveling of the Warsaw Ghetto in 1943 by the Nazis. October 7th marked the dividing line between an Israeli policy that advocated the brutalization and subjugation of the Palestinians and a policy that calls for their annihilation and removal from historic Palestine. What we are witnessing is the equivalent of the moment triggered by the killing of some 200 soldiers led by George Armstrong Custer in June 1876 at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. After that humiliating defeat, Native Americans were slated to be exterminated, with the remnants forced into prisoner of war camps, later named reservations, where tens of thousands died of disease, and lived under the merciless gaze of their armed occupiers while falling into a life of immiseration and despair. Expect the same for the Palestinians in Gaza, dumped, I fear, into one of the world's hellholes and forgotten. The expansion of Greater Israel, which includes the seizing of Syrian territory in the Golan Heights, southern Lebanon, Gaza, and the occupied West Bank, where some 40,000 Palestinians have been driven from their homes since October 7th, and which I expect will soon be annexed by Israel, is being cemented into place. But the genocide in Gaza is only the start. The world is breaking down under the onslaught of the climate crisis, which is triggering mass migrations, failed states, catastrophic wildfires, hurricanes, storms, flooding, and droughts. As global stability unravels, industrial violence, which is decimating the Palestinians, will become ubiquitous. Israel's annihilation of Gaza marks the end of a global order guided by international agreed-upon laws and rules, ones often violated by the U.S. in its imperial wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but ones that were at least acknowledged as a utopian vision. The U.S. and its Western allies not only supply the weaponry to sustain the genocide, but obstruct the demand by most nations for an adherence to humanitarian law. They have carried out attacks against the only nation, Yemen, which has the courage to try to halt the genocide. The message this sends, especially to the global South, is clear. We have everything. If you try and take it away from us, we will kill you. The militarized drones, helicopter gunships, walls and barriers, checkpoints, coils of concertina wire, watchtowers, detention centers, deportations, brutality and torture, denial of entry visas, apartheid existence that comes with being undocumented, loss of individual rights, and electronic surveillance are as familiar to the desperate migrants along the Mexican border or attempting to enter Europe as they are to the Palestinians. Israel, which as Ronan Bergman notes in his book Rise and Kill First, has assassinated more people than any other country in the Western world, cynically employs the Nazi Holocaust to sanctify its hereditary victimhood and justify its settler colonial state, apartheid, campaigns of mass slaughter, and Zionist version of Lebensraum. Primo Levi, who survived Auschwitz, saw the Shoah for this reason as, and I quote, an inexhaustible source of evil, which is perpetuated as hatred in the survivors and springs up in a thousand ways against the very will of all, as a thirst for revenge, as moral breakdown, as negation, as weariness, as resignation. Genocide and mass extermination are not the exclusive domain of fascist Germany. Adolf Hitler, as Ami Cesari writes in Discourse on Colonialism, appeared exceptionally cruel only because he presided over the humiliation of the white man. But the Nazis, he writes, had simply applied colonialist procedures, which until then had been reserved exclusively for the Arabs of Algeria, the coolies of India, and the blacks of Africa. The German slaughter of the Herero and Namaqua, the Armenian genocide, the Bengal famine of 1943, then British Prime Minister Winston Churchill airily dismissed the deaths of 3 million Hindus in the famine by calling them, quote, a beastly people with a beastly religion, along with the dropping of nuclear bombs on the civilian targets of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, illustrates something fundamental about Western civilization. The moral philosophers who make up the Western canon, Immanuel Kant, Voltaire, David Hume, John Stuart Mill, and John Locke, as Nicole Fleetwood points out, excluded enslaved and exploited people, indigenous peoples, colonized people, women of all races, and the criminalized from their moral calculus. In their eyes, European whiteness alone imparted modernity, moral virtue, judgment, and freedom. This racist definition of personhood played a central role in justifying colonialism, slavery, the genocide of Native Americans, our imperial projects, and our fetish for white supremacy. So when you hear that the Western canon is an imperative, ask yourself, for whom? In America, the poet Langston Hughes said, "Negroes do not have to be told what fascism is in action, we know. Its theories of Nordic supremacy and economic suppression have long been realities to us." The Nazis, when they formulated the Nuremberg Laws, modeled them on our Jim Crow era segregation and discrimination laws. Our refusal to grant citizenship to Native Americans and Filipinos, although they lived in the U.S. and U.S. territories, was copied by the German fascists to strip citizenship from Jews. Our anti-miscegenation laws, which criminalized interracial marriage, was the impetus to outlaw marriages between German, Jews, and Aryans. American jurisprudence classified anyone with 1% of black ancestry, the so-called one-drop rule, as black. The Nazis, ironically, showing more flexibility, classified anyone with 3 or more Jewish grandparents as Jewish. And fascism was quite popular in the United States in the 1920s, and the 1930s. The Ku Klux Klan, mirroring the fascist movements sweeping through Europe, experienced a huge revival in the 1920s. Nazis were embraced by American eugenicists who lauded the Nazi goal of racial purity and disseminated Nazi propaganda. Charles Lindbergh, who accepted a swastika medal from the Nazi Party in 1938, along with the evangelist Gerald Winrod's pro-Hitler defenders of the Christian faith, William Dudley Pelley's silver shirts, the initials SS were intentional, and the veteran-based khaki shirts were just a few of our openly fascist organizations. The idea that America is a defender of democracy, liberty, and human rights would come as a huge surprise to those Frantz Fanon, called the wretched of the earth, who saw their democratically elected governments subverted and overthrown by the United States in Panama in 1941, Syria 1949, Iran 1953, Guatemala 1954, the Congo 1960, Brazil 1964, Chile 1973, Honduras 2009, and Egypt in 2013. And this list does not include a host of other governments that, however despotic, as was the case in South Vietnam, Indonesia, or Iraq, were viewed as inimical to American interests and destroyed, in each case inflicting death and immiseration on millions. For empire is the external expression of white supremacy. The millions of victims of racist imperial projects in countries such as Mexico, China, India, the Congo, and Vietnam, for this reason, are deaf to the fatuous claims by Jews that their victimhood is unique. And so are Black, Brown, and Native Americans, because they also suffered Holocausts, but these Holocausts remain minimized or unacknowledged by their Western perpetrators. Israel embodies the ethno-nationalist state the far right in the United States and Europe dreams of creating for themselves, one that rejects political and cultural pluralism, as well as legal, diplomatic, and ethical norms. Israel is admired by these proto-fascists, including Christian nationalists, because it turns its back on humanitarian law to use indiscriminate lethal force to cleanse its society of those condemned as human contaminants. Israel is not an outlier, but expresses our darkest impulses, ones being turbocharged by the Trump administration. I covered the birth of Jewish fascism in Israel. I reported on the extremist Meir Kahana, who was barred from running for office and whose Koch party was outlawed in 1994 and declared a terrorist organization by Israel and the United States. I attended political rallies held by Benjamin Netanyahu, who received lavish funding from AIPAC and right-wing American Jews when he ran against Yitzhak Rabin, who was negotiating a peace settlement with the Palestinians. Netanyahu's supporters chanted, "Death to Rabin." They burned an effigy of Rabin dressed in a Nazi uniform. Netanyahu marched in front of a mock funeral for Rabin. And Rabin was assassinated on November 4, 1995, by a Jewish fanatic. Rabin's widow, Leah, blamed Netanyahu and his supporters for her husband's murder. Netanyahu, who first became prime minister in 1996, has spent his political career nurturing Jewish extremists, including Avigdor Lieberman, Gideon Sarar, Naftali Bennett, and others. His father, Ben Zion, who worked as an assistant to the Zionist pioneer Vladimir Jabotinsky, who Benito Mussolini referred to as a good fascist, was a leader in the Herut Party that called on the Jewish state to seize all the land of historic Palestine. And many of those who formed the Herut Party carried out terrorist attacks during the 1948 war that established the State of Israel. Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, Sidney Hook, and other Jewish intellectuals described the Herut Party in a statement published in the New York Times as, quote, "a political party closely akin in its organization, methods, political philosophy, and social appeal to Nazi and fascist parties." There has always been a strain of Jewish fascism within the Zionist project, mirroring the strain of fascism in American society. Unfortunately for us, the Israelis, and the Palestinians, these fascistic strains are ascendant. The left is no longer capable of overcoming the toxic ultra-nationalism that has evolved here. Zev Sternhill, a Holocaust survivor, and Israel's foremost authority on fascism, warned in 2018. The kind whose European strain almost wiped out a majority of the Jewish people. Sternhill added, "We see not just a growing Israeli fascism, but racism akin to Nazism in its early stages. The decision to obliterate Gaza has long been the dream of far-right Zionists, heirs of Kahana's movement. Jewish identity and Jewish nationalism are the Zionist versions of the Nazis' blood and soil. Jewish supremacy is sanctified by God, as is the slaughter of the Palestinians, who Netanyahu compares to the biblical Amalekites massacred by the Israelites. Euro-American settlers in the American colonies used the same biblical passage to justify the genocide against Native Americans. Enemies, usually Muslims, slated for extinction, are subhuman who embody evil. Violence and the threat of violence are the only forms of communication those outside the magical circle of Jewish nationalism supposedly understand. Messianic redemption will take place once the Palestinians are expelled. Jewish extremists call for the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest shrine for Muslims, built on the ruins of the Jewish Second Temple, which was destroyed in 70 CE by the Roman army, to be demolished. The mosque is to be replaced by a third Jewish temple, a move that would set the Muslim world alight. The West Bank, which the zealots call Judea and Samaria, will be formally annexed by Israel, and Israel will be governed by the religious laws imposed by the ultra-Orthodox Shas and United Torah Judaism parties, meaning Israel will become a Jewish version of Iran. There are already over 65 laws which discriminate directly or indirectly against Palestinian citizens of Israel and those living in the occupied territories. The campaign of indiscriminate killing of Palestinians in the West Bank, many by rogue Jewish militias who have been armed with 10,000 automatic weapons, along with house and school demolitions, and the seizure of remaining Palestinian land is exploding. Israel is this, at the same time, is turning on quote-unquote Jewish traitors within Israel and abroad who refuse to embrace the demented vision of the ruling Jewish fascists who denounce the genocide. The familiar enemies of fascism, journalists, human rights advocates, intellectuals, artists, feminists, liberals, the left, and pacifists are targeted. The judiciary, according to plans put forward by Netanyahu, will be neutered. Public debate will wither. Civil society and the rule of law will cease to exist, and those branded as disloyal will be deported. Israel could have exchanged the hostages held by Hamas for the thousands of Palestinians held hostage in Israeli prisons, often for decades, which is why the Israeli hostages were seized on October 8th. And there is evidence that in the chaotic fighting that took place, once Hamas militants entered Israel, the Israeli military decided to target not only Palestinian fighters, but the Israeli captives with them, killing perhaps hundreds of their own soldiers and citizens. Israel and its Western allies, James Baldwin saw, is headed towards the terrible probability that the dominant nations struggling to hold on to what they have stolen from their captives and unable to look into the mirror will precipitate a chaos throughout the world, which, if it does not bring life on this planet to an end, will bring about a racial war such as the world has never seen. I know these killers. I met them in the dense canopies in the war in El Salvador and Nicaragua. It was there that I first heard the single high-pitched crack of the sniper bullet, distinct, ominous, a sound that spreads terror. Army units I traveled with, enraged by the lethal accuracy of rebel snipers, set up heavy 50-caliber machine guns and sprayed the foliage overhead until a body, a bloodied, mangled pulp, dropped to the ground. I saw them at work in Basra in Iraq, and of course Gaza, where on a fall afternoon at the Netzarim Junction, an Israeli sniper shot dead a young man a few feet away from me. We carried his limp body up the road. I lived with them in Sarajevo during the war. They were only a few hundred yards away, perched in high rises that looked down on the city. I witnessed their daily carnage. At dusk, I saw a Serb sniper fire around in the gloom at an old man and his wife, bent over their tiny vegetable plot. The sniper missed. She ran haltingly for cover. He did not. The sniper fired again. I concede the light was fading. It was hard to see. Then the third time, the sniper killed him. And this is one of those memories of war I see in my head over and over and over and do not like to talk about. I watched it from the back of the Holiday Inn, but by now I have seen it, or the shadows of it, hundreds of times. These killers targeted me too. They struck down colleagues and friends. I was in their sights, traveling from northern Albania into Kosovo with 600 fighters from the Kosovo Liberation Army, each insurgent carrying an extra AK-47 to hand off to a comrade. Three shots, that crisp crack, too familiar. The sniper must have been far away, or maybe the sniper was a bad shot, although the bullets came close. I scrambled for cover behind a rock. My two bodyguards bent over me, panting, the green pouches strapped to their chests, full of grenades. I know how killers talk. The black humor, pint-sized terrorists, they say, of Palestinian children. They are proud of their skills. It gives them cachet. They cradle their weapon as if it is an extension of their body. They admire its despicable beauty. This is who they are, their identities, killers. These killers are numb to the suffering they inflict. Maybe they enjoy it. Maybe they think they are protecting themselves, their identity, their comrades, their nation. Maybe they believe the killing is a necessary evil, a way to make sure Palestinians die before they can strike. Maybe they have surrendered their morality to the blind obedience of the military, subsumed themselves into the industrial machinery of death. Maybe they are scared to die. Maybe they want to prove to themselves and others that they are tough, they can kill. Maybe their mind is so warped that they believe killing is righteous. They, like all killers, are intoxicated by the godlike power to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth. They revel in the intimacy of it. They see in fine detail through the telescopic sight the nose and mouth of their victims, the triangle of death. They hold their breath. They pull slowly, gently on the trigger, and then the pink puff. Severed spinal cord, it is over. They are numb and cold. But it does not last. I covered war for a long time. I know even if they do not, the next chapter of their lives. I know what happens when they leave the embrace of the military, when they are no longer a cog in these factories of death, when the adrenaline rush of combat is gone. I know the hell they enter. It starts like this. All the skills they acquired as a killer on the outside are useless. Maybe they go back. Maybe they become a gun for hire. But this only delays the inevitable. They can run for a while, but they cannot run forever. There will be reckoning, and it is the reckoning I will tell you about. They will face a choice. Live the rest of their lives stunted, numb, cut off from themselves, cut off from those around them, descend into a psychopathic fog, trapped in the absurd interdependent lies that justify mass murder. There are killers years later who say they are proud of their work, who claim not a moment's regret, but I have not been inside their nightmares. If this is the route they take, they will never again truly live. Of course, they do not talk about what they did to those around them, certainly not to their families. They are feted as heroes, but they know, even if they do not say it, that this is a lie. The numbness usually wears off. They look in the mirror, and if they have any shred of conscience left, their reflection disturbs them. They repress bitterness. They escape down the rabbit hole of opioids. Or like my uncle, who fought in the South Pacific in World War II, alcohol. Their intimate relationships, because they cannot feel, because they bury, their self-loathing disintegrate. This escape works for a while. But then they go into such darkness that the stimulants used to blunt the pain begin to destroy them. And maybe that is how they die. I have known many who died like that. And I have known those who ended it quickly, a gun to the head. I have trauma from war, but the worst trauma I do not have. The worst trauma from war is not what you saw. It is not what you experienced. The worst trauma is what you did. They have names for it: moral injury, perpetrator-induced traumatic stress. But this seems tepid given the hot burning coals of rage, the night terrors, the despair. Those around them know something is terribly, terribly wrong. They fear this darkness, but they do not let others into their labyrinth of pain. And then one day they reach out for love. Love is the opposite of war. War is about death. It is about smut. It is about turning other human beings into objects, maybe sexual objects, but I also mean this literally, for war turns people into corpses. Corpses are the end products of war. What comes off its assembly line. So they want love, but death has made a Faustian bargain. It is this. It is the hell of not being able to love. They carry this death inside them for the rest of their lives. It corrodes their souls, and yes, we have souls. They sold theirs. The cost is very, very high. It means that what they want, what they most desperately need in life, they cannot attain. They spend days wanting to cry and not knowing why. They are consumed by guilt. They believe that because of what they did, the life of a son or daughter or someone they care about is in danger. Divine retribution. They tell themselves this is absurd, but they believe it anyway. They start to include little offerings of goodness to others, as if these offerings will appease a vengeful God, as if these offerings will save someone near to them from harm, from death. But nothing wipes away the stain of murder. They are overwhelmed with sorrow, regret, shame, grief, despair, alienation. They face an existential crisis. They know that all the values they were taught to honor in school, at worship, at home, are not the values they upheld. They hate themselves. They do not say this out loud. Shooting unarmed people is not bravery. It is not courage. It is not even war. It is a crime. It is murder. And Israel runs an open-air shooting gallery in Gaza and the West Bank, as we did in Iraq and Afghanistan. Total impunity. Murder as sport. It is exhausting trying to ward off these demons. Maybe they will make it, being human again. But that will mean a life of contrition. It will mean making the crimes public. It will mean begging for forgiveness. It will mean forgiving themselves, and this is very hard. It will mean orienting every aspect of their lives to nurturing life rather than extinguishing it. This is the only hope for salvation, and if they do not take it, they are damned. It will mean rejecting the empty jingoism, the abstract words of glory, honor, and patriotism used to mask the cries of the wounded, the senseless killing, war profiteering, and chest-pounding grief. It will mean rejecting the lies the perpetrators of war do not acknowledge, the lies covered up in stately war memorials and mythic war narratives filled with stories of heroism and comradeship. It will mean rejecting the lies that permeate the thick, self-important memoirs by amoral statesmen and women who make wars but do not know war. For war is necrophilia. War is a state of almost pure sin with its goals of hatred and destruction. War fosters alienation, leads inevitably to nihilism, and is a turning away from the sanctity and preservation of life. All other narratives about war too easily fall prey to the allure and seductiveness of violence, as well as the attraction of the godlike power that comes with a license to kill. We must name and face our darkness. We must repent. Our willful blindness and historical amnesia, our refusal to be accountable to the rule of law, our belief that we have a right to use industrial violence to exert our will marks, I fear, the start, not the end, of the campaigns of mass slaughter by the global north against the world's growing legions of poor and vulnerable. It is the curse of Cain, and it is a curse we must remove before the genocide in Gaza becomes not an anomaly, but the norm. Thank you.
I think that we should take a collective breath. Real spit. Let's do that. Let's put our feet on the ground. Warriors need to breathe too. And take a deep inhale. Thank you for that. Thank you for your work. I think I'm going to start my conversation with you the way I started our interview, because I think it's super important, right? So the title of the book, A Genocide Foretold, right? We knew this was coming. And so the question is, given all that we know about the history of the Israeli invasion, occupation of Palestine, why is it that we could only have ended up where we are right now?
If you go back and look at the writings of all of the early Zionists, I mean, Zionism was split between liberal Zionism and, let's call it, religious or fascistic Zionism. There was always that split, which I spoke about. Liberal Zionists, like American liberals, like most liberals, presented a face to the outside world that masked the intent, which was the total dispossession of Palestinian land. David Ben-Gurion, in his private diaries, is quite upfront about that. You saw large acts of ethnic cleansing or seizure of land in 1948 with the creation of the State of Israel. 750,000 Palestinians were driven from their land, many into Gaza. And then in 1967, in the war, another 350,000 Palestinians were driven off their land. But in between those conflicts, there was a kind of slow motion ethnic cleansing, a huge expansion of settlements. I was in the West Bank last summer. You have over 700,000 Jewish colonists. So it was a kind of creeping expansion. And then with the attacks of October 7th, this essentially gave the Zionists, in their eyes, the green light to finish the job. So what's happening now is worse, I think, at this point than the Nakba, the catastrophe, which took place in 1948. And I think what's so disturbing is that and I've spent quite a bit of time in the Arab world since October 7th, is that it's just totally exposed who we are. I mean, not a surprise if you come from the global south, not a surprise if you're indigenous or if you're black, or the mask is gone, and I don't think it's coming back. I think that this really represents a seismic shift.
That's actually where I wanted to go next, right? So now we're here, and now we're watching, you know, countries in Europe and in the EU and finally, right, finally, saying, oh, maybe this isn't such a good thing that's happening over there. And recently, the EU and France are talking about, right, gathering people together again to reignite the conversation about the two-state solution. What do you say about that in terms of, is there going back? Is there any room for, yeah, I'm going to live peacefully next to you after you murdered 200 of my family members in one shelling, right? Or are we now at the point of no return?
So Israel killed the two-state solution a long time ago, first of all. Second of all of these statements by Macron and Starmer and others do not come unaccompanied by action. The weapons are still, and I think the weaponization of starvation is just so egregious. It's hard to lie about that. You can lie about hospitals being Hamas command centers or human shields or whatever they, but it's very hard to mask the intent of annihilation or dispossession when you use starvation as a weapon, and I really think these people are just covering their ass. They're not gonna do anything, but I think that it's just become so transparent. The genocide has become so transparent that rhetorically they want to distance themselves from what's happening. This genocide would stop tomorrow if we suspended and cut all military shipments to Israel, which of course, we have a moral imperative to do. It's not just the fact that we are sustaining the genocide, because Israel's weapon stocks were depleted a long time ago, and now the heavy repression of, and including these courageous university students, the heavy repression of anyone who speaks up against the genocide, outlawing groups like Jewish Voice for Peace and Students for Justice in Palestine. It's because they don't really have an answer anymore. So if you speak up against what is internationally recognized as the crime of crimes, they come for you, and they come hard.
So I just want to point out that there are cards being handed out, and as you give your questions back to them, they will bring them to me, and I will alternate between my questions and y'all's for Chris. Since Trump, ascended to a second term into his next regime, I've been in a lot of rooms where the question is, right, how do we fight back? How do we resist? And the most poignant of those questions for me is what levers are still available to us, right, in terms of the tools inside of our toolbox? And I'm going there because every time Israel does something super egregious, which is every single day, we've got the IJC, there's all these conversations about, well, that's a violation of international law. Well, he's not allowed to do that because the UN said so. I've heard that so much over the last almost 600 days, right, of what we're talking about, the futility, if you will, of the United Nations and international law. Like, at this point, what is the point of even having that conversation?
Well, I think it's important that at the very least, there's a constant reminder that both Israel and the United States, which is complicit in the genocide, are violating a raft of laws, whether it's the Geneva Convention or the Genocide Convention or anything else, in terms of what must be done. Well, we're in Oakland. What must be done is when weapons are being put on ships to go to Israel, there have to be dock strikes.
We done that one or two times here in Oakland's port, that's for sure.
Well, that's it. I mean, we got to, it isn't going to work unless we disrupt the machine. That's our job. And we owe it to the people of Palestine. And we owe it to ourselves.
Yeah, the days of cute activism are over. And what I mean by that is like coming to talks like these and then going home and posting that you were at a talk like this and that being the end of what you do. That's actually unacceptable in this moment. There's some good stuff here. I'm going to tie a question here to a question I have in the book, because I wanted to talk about resistance a little bit. So I'll start here, and I'll let you know where I'm going. And then I want you to talk a bit about divine violence as a form of resistance. But this question says, can you give us advice about how to protect universities, foreign students, research funding, and academic freedom from the Trump administration?
Well, universities like the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the media have just exposed who they are. They don't work for faculty or students or care about academic freedom. They work for private equity firms and hedge fund managers and on their trustee boards, half of whom should be in prison. Universities have been completely corporatized. I know I've taught at a lot of them, including Princeton. I think I have such admiration for the students. I spent some time in the encampments at both Columbia and Princeton. you know, they are our nation's conscience, and they've paid a price. And you know, when you stand up against radical evil, you are going to pay a price. But what's happened, you know, what happened over the summer in a coordinated effort from last spring to the fall of this academic year is that they imposed a series of measures that turned university campuses into academic gulags, where any whisper of dissent, I mean, we have Ruha Benjamin, one of the great scholars at Princeton, who's teaching on probation. Ruha being Ruha, hasn't stopped speaking out about Palestine because she's a lot bigger than Princeton. It's going to be nasty. And I just had lunch with my friend Rupa Mara, who just got fired from the medical school because she stood up for Palestine. I just came back from Egypt, where I was with Palestinians, and I didn't know what was going to happen when I came back. I did a factory reset on my computer. I had a burner phone. I copied all my notes and left them in London on the way in case they got seized. I mean, that is the world we're entering. That's the and let's be clear that, you know, as I'm sure everyone in this room understands, none of this has anything to do with anti-Semitism. Look at all the neo-Nazis like Elon Musk, and what this is an attack on the left. It is a subterfuge to destroy the left, us, and you know the we have to begin to. They're inflicting a lot of pain, and it's our job to start inflicting pain back.
So in the book, you talk about divine violence, and you illustrate it with the story of Aaron Bushnell, which I think you can just reiterate for yourself. And you also state in the book, you say, if the only language that's being spoken to the oppressed is terror, then the only language that's going to be spoken back is terror.
Well, it's always the oppressor who determines the language of the oppressed. And if, you know, Israel, which it does, uses F-35s and F-16s, which we provide them, and missiles and tank shells and 155s and everything else to obliterate Gaza, well, how do people who don't have an artillery, don't have mechanized units, don't have an air force, don't have a navy, how do they respond? Well, they respond with the tools that they have. Every resistance group, including the ANC, will employ quote-unquote terror as a weapon because they have very little opportunities to respond. I mean, even these rockets, by the way, that are fired, you know, into Israel. I mean, let's be clear, firing rockets towards civilians is a war crime. I'm willing to say that. But these are nothing compared to the, you know, Hellfire missiles or 2,000-pound bombs that Israel will drop in the middle of refugee camps. Yeah, I mean, that is, Israel has shut down every other possibility, including the Great March of Return, where people peacefully approach the barrier with Israel and were just gunned down by snipers. In fact, as Rashid Halady writes in his book, The 100-Year History of Palestine, it's actually the peaceful movements that Israel has meted out the severest violence towards peaceful efforts because they fear those the most. It's called blowback. I mean, believe me, what we're doing in Gaza now is going to create blowback. And what I fear, as I was saying to you earlier for this, is that when there is some kind of a
quote-unquote terrorist response, that's going to be a gift to the Trump administration, which will then flick a switch and shut everything down really quickly. That's my biggest fear.
You said at the beginning of your talk, Chris, that this is the last chapter, right? This is the final push by the Zionists to completely eliminate the Palestinian people. The question here, Ilan Pappé said, this is the beginning of the end of Zionism. He said it would take about 5 years. Your thoughts?
Well, he's one of those Israeli historians I admire immensely, of course. I think despotic states can last for a pretty long time. So I'm not quite as optimistic. I have just spent weeks with Palestinians from Gaza, and they are in utter despair, not surprisingly, living under tremendous stress because they still have family in Gaza. But I think that they understand that unless an outside force halts this genocidal project, they're finished. And I don't know where that outside force is going to come from. And that's why I think that, you know, to the extent that we can mobilize to disrupt the shipment of weapons to Israel, and because they are sent on ships, I mean, I think it really has to be that kind of activity. Because if we don't halt the weapons supplies, then Israel is going to achieve its demented dream of emptying Gaza. I mean, the whole thing with taking or outlawing UNRWA and setting up these ridiculous, they're going to supposedly set up 4 feeding stations. They're all along the border with Rafah. There's a 9-mile border between. Well, part that border is just a fence. I mean, much of it's just a fence. It's, you know, you create, and in order to get to that food, you have to go through Israeli and U.S. contractors' military cordons. I mean, you are essentially agreeing to go into a concentration camp right along the border, and I can see a scenario where you have 2 million people desperate and they just blow a hole in the border. I mean, that's certainly Egypt's fear. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. They clearly want to drive them out. Egypt has been categorical that they're not going to end up in the Sinai. They've talked to Somalia. They've talked to Somaliland. They've talked to Sudan. There have been reports that maybe they'll just bus them in convoys of buses to Syria. And Netanyahu, there was a report in the Hebrew press a few days ago. There was a leaked talk that he gave to his Security Council where he said that our only impediment is we have to find out where to move them to.
I want to turn a little bit to recent headlines, and you brought it up at the beginning of your speech, and that is this NGO that has manifested out of thin air called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, right? 4 stations in southern and central Gaza, none in northern Gaza. Within 24 hours of its establishing itself, some of our worst fears came true, right? 3 Palestinians were murdered, dozens of others injured as they were trying to get to food. What I really reflected on is I was actually prepping to do an interview about it the night before, was the insidiousness of the entity that has created the conditions, then proffering itself up as the solution to those conditions. I mean, it's what the Carceral State of America does all the time. That said, and then this thought that I had that just as on a whim, right, now we're giving you food, on a whim, we can take it away. Again.
But they're not going to give them enough food. So first of all, second of all, they're only giving them dry food, and they don't have any water, and they don't have any fuel. It's what the United States did in the Strategic Hamlet program in Vietnam, where but this is counter. I covered the famine in the southern Sudan. It was the same. You essentially destroy the capacity to produce food. and then you weaponize food to force people to, in this case, leave northern Gaza and collect in the south. They'll use this term voluntary transfer. Voluntary transfer, by the way, is exactly the term the Nazis used in the Warsaw Ghetto when they starved the residents of the ghetto and then in loudspeakers said that everybody would get 3 loaves of bread, if I have this correct, I don't know why, marmalade, and they would get, if they would come to the transports, which took them to Treblinka, and people went because they were starving, because their children were starving. So this is about the weaponization of starvation and the weaponization of food. When I covered the war in Salvador, it was the same. They would destroy the ability of peasant farmers in El Salvador in zones where the rebels operated. They would destroy their farms. They would burn their crops, and then they would, through the USAID, they would have feeding centers that were controlled by the army to try and drive, what they call them, the masas, to try and drive them out, because rebel forces, as Mao correctly pointed out, it's those civilians are the sea in which the rebels live, the fish. It's what happens in all counterinsurgency campaigns. That's what Israel is doing. They're weaponizing starvation and they're weaponizing food. The immediate goal is to drive everyone out of the north, completely empty the north, and seize the north, and to push people into, in essence, because they're controlled. These contractors, U.S. contractors, and the Israeli military control these areas. And you have to go through their cordons to get into it, and I think the goal is clearly to create an humanitarian crisis that is so catastrophic in Israel's mind that Palestinians will want to leave, and finally they will be able to either drive them into Egypt or ship them off somewhere like they did in Beirut with the PLO on boats. I don't know. But that is clearly where they're moving, and I think that Israel thinks that time is running out, that I think we're going to see the denouement of this project in a matter of weeks, not months.
I want to stay for just one more second, and that is, I think, yes, it's a weaponization of starvation, as a tool of war. I also see it very much tied into the ways in which Israel manipulates narrative. That they're doing this with their left hand, but they're only showing you the right hand. So to your point, they're only providing dry food. The other thing is that there are so many people, tens of thousands, that are beyond the point of where food is going to solve your problem, right? That are to the point where it's food, it's medical, attend. It's all of it, right? Even though there's these 4 feeding stations, these people are still going to die en masse.
Yeah, well, let's be clear that in normal times, normal being when Gaza was under siege and Israel restricted the caloric intake of every Palestinian, you had 500 trucks a day. This is the amount of food that Israel is letting in is, number one, is a joke. It is not meant to in any way to sustain. I mean, there have been statements, Smotrich and others in the Israeli press said, well, we had to do this to alleviate the pressure of the international community, but don't worry. It's just a public relations game. You can read it. Smotrich and Ben-Gavir both said this publicly. So it's a very, very cynical game. But yes, you're right, Kat. People with cancer, people on dialysis, the hospitals don't function. People are being, having limbs amputated without anesthesia. I interviewed people in Egypt who had their limbs amputated without anesthesia, legs. It's every system that sustains life. I mean, all the bakeries are bombed. Israel bombs the wells. There's no clean water. By cutting electricity, the last water desalination plant doesn't function. So everybody's drinking out of these fetid pools of water. And of course, this is devastating to children and to, you know, people with health issues. We are seeing now kids starve to death, and over the border, a couple kilometers away are 2,000 actually aid trucks that Israel won't allow in. So it's just I often wonder what was the point of all these Holocaust studies in these universities. Obviously, they didn't get it. The point of the Holocaust is not that Jews are eternal victims. The point of the Holocaust is that when you have the capacity to stop genocide and you do not, you are culpable.
I have a couple of questions from educators. I'm going to group them together. Basically, the essence of the question is, how do I talk to young people? How do I talk to students about this? And then I think part two, if I'm summarizing these correctly, is also about doing this. You and I were talking about this back then, right? Speaking truth, knowing that any moment you'll be drug away for speaking that truth. And against the backdrop of censure is how these... Oh, and Zionist parents.
Well, that's like Nazi parents. How are you going to deal with that? So
truth-telling tonight.
Yeah, Omar Hadid. There's two good books. Muhammad Okurd wrote a really good book called Perfect Victims, and they're both beautiful writers. Omar Hadid wrote a book called One Day Everyone Will Have Been Against This. I'm sure that once it's all done, these academic institutions who exhibited stunning moral cowardice will run seminars, and people will write their dissertations on it and get... how do we talk about it? I don't think that you can teach morality. I think that morality that you exhibit or you are willing to pay the cost for taking a moral stance, and that inspires others to take a moral stance. And I think one of the most depressing things that I found is the just how the faculty, even faculty that will teach these kinds of courses about genocide, they just ran into their little rat holes. It just exposed their hypocrisy completely. And I know, because I know a lot of these students, and they're so dispirited and so... And of course, their own faculty won't stand up for them. I think that... I'm not sure we can teach it. I think that it's, people like Ruha or others, or Catherine Franke, who was fired after 25 years, she's Jewish, from Columbia Law School, who stood up. I think that's the most effective form of showing people the cost of a moral stance. I mean, you may know my father was a Presbyterian minister and was driven out of the church for standing up for GBLTQ rights. My uncle was gay. He was told by the church to stop speaking out on behalf of GBL. And his response instead was to organize an Easter service. He had a church in Syracuse and invite the GBLT community. And I did my undergraduate degree at Colgate, which was a narrow way. He came and got me. He said, this is the last time you'll hear me preach. He knew what they were going to do to him. And he got up. And, the churches in particular were especially cruel to the GBLT community. His sermon was, marriage is a sacrament. It's not a reward for being a heterosexual. Any church that doesn't honor the sacrament of marriage can't call itself Christian. And they got rid of him, And years later, when I was speaking out about the invasion of Iraq, you know, calling, it was a very, as you remember, 9/11, it was a very, I mean, my phone bank at the New York Times was filled with death threats. And finally, I was issued a formal written reprimand by the Times, and I was told, although I speak Arabic and spent 7 years in the Middle East, that I was not allowed to speak about the war in Iraq. And when I was in the office, it really came down to that moment where I realized that I could muzzle myself and pay fealty to my career, but to do so would be to betray my father. And I couldn't do that. And I remember walking out of the paper and I think articulating for the first time the gift that my father had given me, and that was freedom. I didn't need the New York Times to tell me who I was. I knew who I was. I was my father's son. And so I think that it's so important, and I, you know, I'll go back to Rupa, who's, you know, they're trying to take, they fired her from the medical school. They're trying to take away her medical license so she can't practice as a doctor. And her children are asking. I told her, this is the greatest gift you've given to your children. The greatest gift. Not that it's easy or it's not. I know, I've been there. But when we talk about morality, you know, we all like to talk about morality, but it's about doing morality. That will impart more morality. Courage is contagious. Doing the right thing is contagious. You know, even small numbers. I remember talking to Jesse Jackson about Birmingham. He said, don't get fooled. There weren't that many people in the streets. Most of the people stayed on the sidewalk. But you, that core, that's really, I think, given the emergent fascism of our country, it's absolutely moving with astonishing speed. The walls are closing in on us. It's time to stop talking and start doing.
you used the word emergent before you said fascism. Say more.
Well, if this was truly a fascist state, you and I would not be sitting here and you would not be in this hall. We are certainly headed in that direction. And it's coming sooner rather than later. But I wouldn't go so far. I mean, I've covered authoritarian, I've lived in authoritarian and despotic states, and an event like this wouldn't even be possible. And we have to use the space while we still have it.
And we are watching, right? Go ahead. And we are watching this government, right, disappear people very quickly that it doesn't appreciate their voices. And I was telling Chris before we came out here, I do the show from the House, and I had this moment. The co-founder of APTP, Terha Ak, told me a long time ago to take myself as seriously as the state takes me. And I give that same advice to y'all. And I sort of guffawed at it. But anyway, I was sitting at my table, I was getting ready to do the show, and I looked at my door, and I for the first time, I actually could see, right, someone coming to my house and dragging me out. That we are in those times now where truth-telling absolutely comes with consequences.
Yeah, I think if there is a terrorist attack, either domestically or on American interests, then the big SUV with the tinted windows is going to arrive for a lot of us. Yeah.
This is a question about, so every Monday on Law and Disorder, we do an hour called Palestine Post. We spend the whole hour talking about what's happening in Palestine. And we do that on purpose to beat back the false narrative, the trash that we see on CNN and MSNBC. But we don't just talk about the horrific things that are happening, right? As a lifelong freedom fighter, I have for decades at this point, gotten inspiration from the freedom fighters in Palestine, right? So we spend a lot of time talking about what Israel is doing to Palestine, not a lot of time talking about the resistance that Palestinians, no matter what comes their way, right, that they continue to engage in. And so there's a question here about where you, I'm summarizing your question, sorry, where and you saw that resistance on the ground. And you could talk about it in your book, too. You talk about Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, it's 75 years of resistance. Pretty remarkable. I mean, when the ceasefire came, what did the Palestinians in southern Gaza do? They went home. They went to the north. Their houses were rubble, but they pitched crude tarps and tents. They went back, which stunned the Israelis, because now they have to ethnically cleanse the north again. No, the Palestinian resistance has been, I mean, especially given what's been arrayed against them, really inspiring. I think that, I mean, it's, for those of us, I spent a lot of 7 years covering Gaza, lived in Gaza, spent a lot of time in Gaza, and, you know, if the world community intervened in a meaningful way, this would stop. And the utter refusal on the part of Western governments to halt a genocide, I think it certainly stunned the Palestinians. I mean, the mantra that people in Egypt kept saying is, they don't see us as human. And then they said, you know, that has a very corrosive, these are their words, a very corrosive effect where we suddenly begin to question our own worth. Are we worth anything? This is what we were talking about it before. This is what colonizers always do. They instill within the colonized the sense that they are worthless. But this is the message that not just Israel, but all of us, I speak as a member of the West, have given to the Palestinians. You are worthless. I mean, we will rue this moment. The consequences of this are not just for the Palestinians, but for us, is staggering. And it really is up to us, because we are the ones who can stop it. Only us. If weapons stop coming from this country, the genocide ends and the Palestinians have a chance. If we are unable to stop the weapon supplies, then Israel will achieve its demonic dream of seizing all of historic Palestine and driving the Palestinians out.
I'm sorry, ma'am. If you want to write it on a piece of paper, they'll bring it to me. Thank you so much. I've got like 25 questions up here, and surely not enough time. I'm going to go back to the UN because this question has asked me to. It says, Chris, what do you think? There was a call being put out globally demanding that the UN initiate Article 42 of the UN Charter to immediately send UN peacekeepers into Gaza to stop the killing and to immediately open and protect all aid routes with UN troops, and that all humanitarian aid will be delivered and distributed by UNRWA with no Israeli or US intervention nor private contractors. Override the US veto.
Yeah, I mean, the Egyptians have a plan to rebuild Gaza, but none of this can be done without Israeli acquiescence. So that's the problem. And Israel is allowed to violate international law with impunity, and there are no consequences. And for those of us who covered this issue for a long time, it's not that we didn't know. There was, you know, B'Tselem, the great Israeli human rights group, El Haq, the 400-page Goldstone report, on and on and on. Israel's crimes have been well documented over the decades, but they have never paid a price. And I think that refusal over the years to make Israel pay a price for the crimes that they committed, including, of course, in Lebanon, 1982, and means, you know, allowed them, or and they were correct, to feel that they could ratchet up the assault on Palestinians to the level of a genocide, and there would be no intervention. So this is it's a moral failure of the moment, but it's also, on the whole issue of Palestine, it's a moral failure of decades, where Israel's crimes were not hidden. Israel's crimes were documented in detail, and nobody did anything.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure. She told me I just have one more question left, but I wasn't ready. My guess is that anyone in this room, if they could, if they had the power, would end the genocide right now. Would have ended it, right? This iteration of the genocide, because let me be clear, it didn't start on October 7th. We all know this, yes? I know that you don't have a crystal ball. I do, however, every morning as I'm waking up to get ready to embark on truth-telling, find myself having this moment of, really? They're not stopping it? Like, really? These even though I know the evils of world powers and that they're all colonizers and that this is right in line with how they've been operating for hundreds of years, I wonder, do you think there will come a point, maybe soon, where folks are finally like, you know, where Macron maybe puts his, you know, his money where his mouth is? I mean, even Hitler was allowed to go on, right, until there was sort of this point of no return. Israel has passed, I think, even that. I believe that we got to stay in the streets. I always believe that the power is with the people. And I believe that we're going to need some gun power. We're going to need some fight power to go in there and cut this.
Well, I certainly hope nobody in here voted for Kamala Harris.
Y'all already know what I did.
Genocide is not a political issue, it's a moral issue. And so, you know, that was certainly my message during the political campaign. You cannot, in even something as insignificant as a vote, remember, what was that great line? If voting was that effective, it'd be illegal. Emma Goldman. Yeah, so I just think on big and small levels, we have to do everything within our power to make those institutions and people who perpetuate genocide pay a price. I can't begin to express, for those of us who have spent significant time in Palestine and in Gaza, the level of frustration, and I share with you, Kat, this, you know, I wake up and, you know, I keep wishing it was just a bad dream. The fact that this kind of daily savagery, we all know the genocide is live-streamed. We all can see it. And the fact that this is, you know, that we as a country embrace it. Now that said, 77% of registered Democrats believe that there should be an arms embargo on Israel. What is it, 82? Well, that just is an example of how the Democratic Party does not function as a legitimate political party. And they deserve the 27% approval rating that they have. I don't know who those 27.
Part.
What is it? I don't know who the 27% are. Clueless compatriots. I've long argued, as you may know, I worked with Ralph Nader. I was a speechwriter. I've long argued and believed, like Ralph, that we have to step outside the system. We should have done this in 1994 with NAFTA. The moment they betrayed the working class, 30 million mass layoffs, we should have walked out on the Democratic Party and stood with the working class. And we didn't. We mouthed, I'm not we, I use that rhetorically, this hollow rhetoric while we betrayed the working class, and look what they vomited up. Trump and, you know, they remind me of the Snopeses. Anybody read Faulkner's? Well, go read it, you know. They're bigamist and an arsonist and somebody who copulates with a cow and somebody who sells tickets to watch the bestiality. That's all. That's who run the country now, the Snopeses. But that's what I covered the breakdown of Yugoslavia was the same. And remember, you know, these people are always clownish and buffoonish, but they're killers. The Nazis were the same. And we're in really, really serious trouble. It's gonna be costly. It's gonna be painful. They're gonna take a lot of us down. But if we're gonna save what's left of our anemic democracy and our open society, we're gonna have to take to the streets, and we're going to have to disrupt the machinery of power in every way possible, because that is the only message they care about, and that is, you know, fear. And it's that old story, which you've probably heard me tell. I've told it a million times, but it's in Kissinger's memoir in 1971. There's a huge anti-war demonstration. You know, Nader says our last liberal president was Nixon, not because Nixon was a liberal, but he was scared of movements. And so Nixon set up empty buses in a ring around the White House. You can't make this up. And he's looking out the window, and he says, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. Well, that's just where we want people in power to be. That's our job, to put
started this evening by saying that you had to take the truth that you were going to inhale in here and go out there and do something with it. We all have a moral obligation to get about the business of confronting what we're facing right now. I do want to say, though, we don't all have to do it in the same way. We actually lose if we all do it in the same way. The movement needs people to be in the streets. It also needs people to watch the babies. It needs people to write the press releases. It needs people to make the clothes. It needs people to plant the food. Right, there's so many roles and ways for you to get about the business of liberatory struggle. Find what makes your heart sing and do that. All right. Chris Hedges, it has been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much.